Well, we did actually attempt to take the blues stuff through the circuit of clubs that existed, but we really didn't get very far, particularly once we got outside the local pubs and youth clubs around Blackpool, where the novelty of being a blues group was... I mean, we're only playing maybe to 20 or 30 people a night, but we had a little coterie of fans that were following us around even then. But once we set off into the real world, as it were, to places like Bolton and Manchester and Macclesfield and Burnley and Bradford and places around the north of England, soul music ruled the day, and everybody was doing covers of Sam and Dave and such like, and Otis Redding and that sort of stuff. So in order to get any gigs at all, you know, we had to do some of that, which, I mean, was just, none of us could play. I certainly couldn't sing. And in order to give it some credibility, we enrolled a couple of saxophone players into the band to give it some semblance of being a kind of R&B stroke soul group. And the blues things that we'd been doing got modified into a kind of jazz blues feel, you know, a sort of, you know, slightly more of a kind of big band feel to a small band arrangement. And it wasn't something I was very happy with at all. I didn't feel comfortable with it, but, you know, that was what we had to do to find work. But as soon as we went down to London, then we reverted instantly to being a blues band again. And although we were being still sold as a seven-piece, only four of us turned up. And we used to just say that, you know, they were stuck on the motorway somewhere, or they'd been in a car accident or something, you know. And never mind, they weren't very good anyway, we used to say. Oh, we won't give in, let's go
living in the past. Hi, welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Well, I was born in Dunfermline, which is in the relatively in the lowlands of Scotland, the bit nearest our Scotland's southern peninsula, otherwise known as England. That's just an in-joke for Scotsmen, don't worry about it. But I was born in Dunfermline, also incidentally the home of Andrew Carnegie, who built the Carnegie Hall in New York, but just by the by. And then moved for most of my childhood to Edinburgh, the capital really of Scotland. And then my parents, for some peculiar reason, decided to remove us to the north of England, to a very tacky sort of holiday town called Blackpool, which, I mean, I defy anyone to actually say they like. It's just not a very nice place to be. It's just full of the lower end of tourism, a lot of drunk sort of hooligans in the summer, and in the winter it's just like death, you know, the place is just empty and boarded up and horrible. Because my parents had actually met there, you know, having been drunken hooligans. No, Blackpool actually, so the irony is Blackpool began as a very respectable Victorian watering hole as a holiday resort in the late 1800s. It was really quite a smart and chic place to go because it had sand and beaches and a relatively mild climate. But during the years, it deteriorated, as places tend to do. My parents first met there when I think it was still quite a nice place, and had harboured ideas of retiring there. Which is what they did. What they failed to realise was Blackpool wasn't the same place as it was when they met. And having moved back there, I think they both really regretted it, but we'd sort of made a big commitment, and so there we stayed until I actually finally managed to get away and get out of school and spent a year or so at art school and went off to the south to try and seek my fortune as a musician.
Some fun.
And so I moved down to the London area and struggled for about a year until Jethro Tull was born out of the remnants of a school group that I had in Blackpool, which was called the John Evan Band, and needless to say featured John Evans along with Barry Barlow and Geoffrey Hammond at various points in that school group. And they rejoined Jethro Tull when the places, as it were, became vacant, and they were the only other guys I'd ever played with, so they kind of rejoined the group later on in sort of period late 69, I think. John Evans came into, he was by then studying pharmacy down in London, and Geoffrey Hammond joined in, I think, 71, when we were making the Aqualung album, and Barry Barlow joined a year later, in beginning of 72. So it was, you know, it was a kind of strange thing where that that early group that I had started when I was, I suppose, 16 or 17, when I was still at school in the north of England, largely constituted the most long-standing lineup of Jethro Tull up until the current one.
Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for Benefit.
Well, what we began playing was actually Black American Blues. That was my entry into playing music. Began with the sort of Muddy Waters, the John Lee Hookers, Howlin' Wolf, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Sonny Boy Williamson. You know, I mean, the works. We listened to all that stuff. We did sort of pale imitations of lots of those songs, as well as beginning to try and concoct some things in that style for ourselves. And that was being paralleled down in London by the quite a boom in blues music. For instance, very early on by someone who recently died, actually, a fellow called Alexis Korner, who, amongst others, gave people like the Rolling Stones their start. And, in fact, I remember Alex coming down with a young chap called Robert Plant when we were playing in some little club in London and saying, do you mind if this chap sits in with you? He's a really good harmonica player. And it was part of the beginning of a rather tense relationship between me and Robert Plant, because, well, nice guy though he was, I mean, he jumped at the chance to get up and try and steal the show, which of course he did, because he was a much better singer than I was. And so I was sort of standing off to one side, feebly puffing at the flute, you know, while this sort of, you know, blonde god sort of hogged the centre stage and did his stuff, you know. And so I was a bit upset about it, and which I'm sure he realised. And I was a bit annoyed with Alexis for bringing this guy down, knowing that this was the whole point of the exercise, was to, you know, because he took Robert around all the bands and all the clubs trying to get him noticed, you know. And but anyway, that's just by the by. Luckily, he didn't show up every night.
Nothing is easy, the time gets you worried, my friend, it's okay. Just take your life easy and stop all that hurrying, be happy my way. When tension starts mounting and you've lost count of the pennies you missed, try hard to see why they're not worrying me, the last on my list. Nothing's easy.
Thank you. Jethro Tull's new album, Stand Up, sounds a little like Roland Kirk playing flute over Cream, but not very much, where you'll probably want to have it anyway. Jethro Tull and their new album, Stand Up, are on Reprise, whatever that means, where they belong, whatever that means.
Well, we did actually attempt to take the blues stuff through the circuit of clubs that existed, but we really didn't get very far, particularly once we got outside the local pubs and youth clubs around Blackpool, where the novelty of being a blues group was... I mean, we're only playing maybe to 20 or 30 people a night, but we had a little coterie of fans that were following us around even then. But once we set off into the real world, as it were, to places like Bolton and Manchester and Macclesfield and Burnley and Bradford and places around the north of England, soul music ruled the day, and everybody was doing covers of Sam and Dave and such like, and Otis Redding and that sort of stuff. So in order to get any gigs at all, you know, we had to do some of that, which, I mean, was just, none of us could play. I certainly couldn't sing. And in order to give it some credibility, we enrolled a couple of saxophone players into the band to give it some semblance of being a kind of R&B stroke soul group. And the blues things that we'd been doing got modified into a kind of jazz blues feel, you know, a sort of, you know, slightly more of a kind of big band feel to a small band arrangement. And it wasn't something I was very happy with at all. I didn't feel comfortable with it, but you know that was what we had to do to find work. But as soon as we went down to London, then we reverted instantly to being a blues band again. And although we were being still sold as a seven piece, only four of us turned up, and we used to just say that, you know, they were stuck on the motorway somewhere, or they'd been in a car accident or something, you know. Never mind, they weren't very good anyway, we used to say. So the then four-piece Jethro Tull, well, in fact, it was the four-piece John Evans Band at the time, before it was actually called Jethro Tull, was hawked around the clubs and as a four-piece until we got sufficiently noticed and rebooked, by which time we were called, amongst many other names, Jethro Tull. So that was the name we had to stick with and live with at the point where we became sufficiently adept at what we were doing to be asked back. Well, it was actually the Ellis Wright Agency, which was Terry Ellis and Chris Wright, the founders of the later Chrysalis Records, with whom we still reside as a record company. And they were both from the north of England, moved down south just before we did to try and set up in the agency business. And we, and 10 years after, I think, were their first groups.
Whenever I get to feel this way, hard to find new words to say. I think about the bad old days we used to know. Nights of winter turn me cold. Fears of dying, getting old. We ran the race was won by running slow. Could be soon we'll cease to sound. Slowly upstairs, faster down. Then to revisit stony grounds we used to know. Remembering mornings, shillings spent. Made no sense to leave the bed. The bad old days, they came and went. Giving way to fruitful years. We'll be right back.
to push the other's land. Take what we can before the man says it's time to go. Each to his own way, I'll go mine. Best of luck with what you find. But for your own sake, remember times we used to know.
Hi, welcome back to In the Studio with Benefit. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Well, the Marquee Club sadly no longer exists. It was a founding place for everybody. I mean, going back to those early days of the blues, you see, there were people like John Mayall's Blues Breakers. Now, John Mayall is not that much of a household name in the United States, but he certainly was back in the UK and in Europe at the time, and although he's had his ongoing career since then and remained very true to his roots, he was more importantly perhaps known as being the home of a series of very, very good musicians who went on to play in other bands, such as, for instance, Eric Clapton. Also, Peter Green was another guitar player that played with John Mayall. Mick Taylor, who was with the Stones for a while, was also with John Mayall. I mean, he played host to a whole series of people, rather like Zappa. He was very much the equivalent of Frank Zappa in this country. So Mayall was down there doing his stuff, and at one point actually did try to woo Mick Abrahams away from Jethro Tull to join his band. Just an interesting aside there, and Mick probably wishes that he'd gone, but he didn't, and then later he did, but not to John Mayall. There was a whole bunch of people who were very instrumental in, I suppose, were my, not role models, but were very influential, musically speaking, in terms of showing you that there was something more to the blues than just a 12-bar sequence, you know, that there was something that you could go towards, which, in fact, evolved into progressive rock. I mean, there was a group called the Graham Bond Organization, which was a renegade jazz trio and later quartet, consisting of this rather strange guy called Graham Bond, who played alto sax and a fiery Hammond organ and sang in a sort of raspy voice. But Dick Hextall-Smith on tenor sax, but a notable bass player by the name of Jack Bruce, and an equally notable drummer by the name of Ginger Baker, who obviously teamed up with Eric Clapton from Mayall's band to form Cream. And so all these things were happening, you know, and it was a sort of fast and furious melting pot of talent. And at the time that I was just beginning to play at the Marquee, I mean, I could go there on my days off, which were relatively many back then because we didn't have that many gigs to play, and see, I mean, just every night of the week, I mean, you could be seeing Traffic, Mayall, King Crimson, Spooky Tooth, Yes, you know, a whole series of Joe Cocker. I mean, like, it was just night after night after night. Many of the bands who played there every week or every 2 weeks, you know, went on to have very high profile careers elsewhere in the world, and notably in America. It was a very, very bustling time, that sort of period, 67, 68, at the Marquee. I mean, I think it produced a staggering number of bands. Prior to that, of course, there'd been the Stones and the Who and the Yardbirds, which then went on to evolve in a roundabout way into Led Zeppelin. So, I mean, the Marquee had been active as a sort of... launching pad for a number of groups prior to that, but I think 68 was a very, I mean, it almost seems that almost everybody who went into the Marquee and survived to play more than two or three dates there, you know, went on to have some notable success. And we were just one of them. I mean, we were no better, no worse than everybody else. It's just that, you know, everybody, it seemed just a very, very important place to be. And it was a very good place because it gave you a feeling of being part of a movement which was very evident in Britain at the time, which was that, was really the true origin of that term progressive rock, because it was a move into a very sort of eclectic kind of jungle, musical jungle, and people were coming at it from blues, from pop, from jazz, from all sorts of angles, but it evolved into that vast number of groups that became the overblown, overly adventurous sort of dinosaurs that the 70s, the mid-70s and later 70s spawned. So, you know, it was an exciting time, but a few of the bands obviously still survive today, although having many of the names I've just mentioned, of course, are still around, thankfully.
Still the easiest way, I have to say. So when you look into the sun, see all the things we haven't done. Was it better than to run and spend the summer crying? Now summer cannot come anyway. I had waited for time to change up. The only change that came over me. She pretended not to want love. I hope she was only fooling me. So when you look into the sun, look for the pleasures nearly won. Or was it better than to run and to spend the summer singing? And summer could have come in a day. It's not too late, only begun. No.
to the sun.
Well, it was the first time I was in the position of having to sit down and write all the songs for an album, so I suppose necessity being the mother of invention, there was I really had to get on with it. And I had a few ideas from the period when Mick was in the band, which were ideas that probably I floated past him but didn't really strike a responsive chord in that direction, because Mick was more of a kind of blues and jazz-oriented guy. He didn't take to the slight nuances of folk or classical music, and I just felt back then that something to steer us away from being just another blues band or just a blues band with a flute player, would be a good idea. So when Mick left the band, let us not be coy about this, Mick Abrahams was ejected forcefully from the group because he decided that he didn't want to play more than three nights a week. And he definitely said there was no way he was going to travel abroad or, go to America or anywhere like that. And the rest of us, of course, were a bit dismayed by that approach, because we all wanted to, get as many dates as we could. If it meant playing every night of the week, then that was fine by us. And if we got a chance to go and see some other parts of the world, then again, that was the whole point of the exercise. So we tried to talk him into, making more of an effort, but he didn't. And things came to a head when one day, having had his mother ring up to say that he was ill and couldn't come to the fourth gig of that week, we had to cancel the show. And Clive Bunker, the drummer, later found him in a cinema in Luton with his girlfriend. I mean, with Mick's own girlfriend, not with Clive's. We won't compound the problem by telling the story wrongly. But Mick did actually do the unforgivable thing of pretending to be ill and causing a cancellation. So after that, we all decided he would have to go. And so we, the other three of us, explained politely that we really had to find another guitar player. But Mick went on to some moderate success with a group called Bloodwind Pig, and over the years he's played a bit here and there between stints as being a lifeguard, an insurance agent, and an investment advisor, believe it or not. It was received pretty well. I mean, we released the album, I think, at the beginning of 1969, but at any rate, it was at a time when we were still very active in the US in that year. I think we did three tours, you see, in 69 in America. So Stand Up didn't really get any tour support from us, but nonetheless it did. I can remember, at the risk of dropping more names, but I can remember sitting in Lowe's Midtown Hotel on 8th Avenue in New York, and Joe Cocker came in to breakfast, sort of rather bleary-eyed, and said, "Hey, congratulations, your album's just gone to number one." So he was, in fact, the bringer of the good news that we actually had a number one album in the UK while we were away in the States. Well, I think what happened was that there were some things on the Stand Up album which were riff-oriented, things like A New Day Yesterday, which had sort of prominent, big-sounding guitar riffs, and we, having spent a year playing around America, I think that kind of approach had become distilled into a sort of riff rock kind of feel, and I think we just took that further on the Benefit album into doing a number of songs that employed fairly prominent guitar riffs, with or without flute accompaniment as well. And because we were also, by then I think we were also playing with people like Mountain, who, I mean, you will recall, there was a lot of the Cream sort of influence in there, Eric Clapton and Felix was in that group as well, and there was a sort of Jack Bruce influence on Felix, both in his bass playing and his singing, and obviously Eric Clapton influenced Leslie West a great deal. So there was, again, that sort of continuity of something British that bounced back to America and then kind of also rubbed off on us a bit, because we just spend a whole tour touring with a band like Mountain. Mutually sort of learned a few new tricks from working with each other.